going to be reading from The Spirits of Christmas, The Dark Side of the Holidays. Be back in a minute. Grab your popcorn and snacks. Find a comfy spot, take a seat or lie down, and let me transport you to a place of fantasy, ghost stories, ancient legends, odd creatures, alien encounters, and other magical topics. You may even decide to join the conversation. From faraway lands to your own backyard, with a small dash of pixie dust, turn out the lights and open your minds. The journey is about to begin. Good evening, everybody. Give me a second to get set up here. Make sure I hit the right buttons. Of course, the neighbors have to start making noises. Give me a second here. I'm going to start up TikTok, and we'll get the show on the road. Then we'll do my intros. Give me a second. Okay, welcome everybody. Good evening. Good evening. My name is Charlotte. I'm going to be your host for the next hour or so. I'm also the owner of the California Haunts Paranormal Investigation Team based out of Sacramento, California. We are 45 strong up and down the state, which means what is going on here? This isn't good. Well, we don't care about that. Okay, fine. All right. That scared me. I thought we lost our page. where was I? Yes. We are 45 strong up and down the state of California, which means if you think you have a paranormal need, we can help you out. It might take us a while, but we can get to you. California is this big state. Just contact us on social media. Just Google us. You can find us everywhere. February 2nd. Everybody have a great weekend. I'm so sorry about the 49ers. That's a bummer. Bummer, bummer, bummer. But you know what? They've got a good team for next year, so they can start looking forward to that. I'm really sorry for you guys in Triple City. It's also Groundhog Day. It's my birthday today. And I got to go to a really nice dinner, which is why we're doing this at 7 p.m. Pacific instead of our usual 5 p.m. time. Because I went to dinner tonight. So I got to spend time with you guys. I took TikTok along with me for dinner. Anyway, I want to thank everybody for coming tonight. We're going to be reading from the Spooky Christmas, the Spooky Holiday book. Don't know if we're going to be done tonight. I think we're close to being done. Really close to being done. So hopefully tonight's the night. And then what I'm going to do is let you guys choose what book we read next. Okay, I'm going to give you guys like a list of 5 books, and you can pick and choose what you would like to read next, whatever we start on, possibly next Sunday. But anyway, welcome to the show. If you want to find us, like I said, you can find us all over social media. I also do a TikTok show every night, Monday through Saturday. I do some tarot card readings, 3 card readings, past, present, future, and they're free. So you can come on and do that. I also do private tarot card readings. You can contact me via email on social media for that as well. CaesarsGhost123@gmail.com if you would like a private reading. I do private readings. Okay, that being said, hello, Marisa Haynes. Welcome. Here we go. Let's get this show on the road. There's no place we really left off. We left off at the last story. So we're just going to read. It's around 7:10 p.m. Pacific right now. We're going to read till about 8:10 p.m. Pacific. And then we'll call it a night. But as you can tell, I've already taken down the Christmas backdrop in here. You know, we're shifting back to normal stuff. And tonight, I'll be attempting to book some shows for California Haunts Radio. So hopefully I can start getting some letters out for that as well. Okay. Hi, Kathy. I see you over there in TikTok. I hope I have a moderator over there somewhere. If not, well, we'll just take our chances with what's going over. I do have a goal of 10 corgis. I'm sorry, 10 rock stars. If anybody would like to gift, that's great. Just know that all that any funding from over there goes towards my paranormal team and not me. It pays the internet bills. It pays, you know, pays stuff for them, and it pays for gas and things like that, so we can go to investigations and take you guys with us. We're gonna take you guys live, you know, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok. We're gonna take all you guys with us on ghost hunts coming up here, so that does help pay for those kinds of fees as well, plus equipment replacement, things like that. I'm just here volunteering my time. All right. Okay. If I don't acknowledge your comments over there at TikTok, it's because I cannot see them. They're teeny tiny for me, so I'm gonna be reading the book over here. Okay. So just to let you know, to do gift, thank you for any and all gifts. All right. And for you guys over here watching on the other channels, if you would like to gift, I do have a ticker running along the bottom that shows you how you can donate and do that. So you have the opportunity to do that as well. All right. Oh, yes. Double tap that screen over there. If you want to see those likes. See those likes come up. See how many likes we can get in the next hour. All right. Let us continue. This book is written by Sylvia Schultz. Excellent author. We've read this book before. Love it. There's some really spooky stuff in here. And it's not only ghost stories. It's a combination of different types of horror stories that have happened, like fires and things like that, that have happened in and around the holidays is what this focus is. So it's an interesting book. But right now, we're right in the middle, smack middle of a bunch of ghost stories. So here we go. And let's do this. I've got my old tablet. I've got my 8-inch tablet. Mrs. Pickman's Ghost. Max Kubis lie awake in bed early that December in 1913. There was a real Wisconsin blizzard howling around the house, the winds piling the snow into deep drifts. But something else was keeping him from sleep, a faint scratching sound. I do this? There you go. A faint scratching sound coming from somewhere in the house. It wasn't on the second floor where the family slept. It seemed to be coming from the first floor. It sounded like someone walking around in slippered feet, pacing the night away in the darkness. Max couldn't stand it any longer. He got up out of bed, careful not to wake his wife, Julia. He tiptoed quietly across the room. He held his breath as he reached for the doorknob. He didn't want the squeak of the opening of the door to wake Julia or the two girls, Helen and Armilla, who slept peacefully in the bedroom across the hall. The moment his hand touched the doorknob, a terrible pounding on the front door echoed through the house. Julia sat bolt upright with a yelp, and the girls called out from their room. Max thought briefly about going to answer the door, but before he could take a step outside the bedroom, the front door crashed open, and heavy footsteps tramped through the front hallway into the kitchen. Julia and the girls joined Max as he stood in the upstairs hallway, trying to summon the courage to peer over the banister. "Who's there?" Max demanded, as his wife and daughters huddled close to him. "I'm going to see what's going on," Max muttered to Julia. And the girls followed him closely as he cautiously went to the stairs, flipped on the light, and went down to the first floor. They searched the entire house, but found no one. As the month wore on, the winter grew fiercer. One night, sometime later, Julia slipped out of bed before dawn to add more wood to the bedroom stoves. She was halfway across the room when a misty figure materialized next to the stove. The figure coalesced into the apparition of an elderly woman who held her hands out to the stove as if trying to warm them. The ghost vanished moments later. The Kubis family decided to investigate the history of their home. Perhaps a former resident had returned. The old lady at the wood stove and the nocturnal prowler might possibly be the same spirit. Max and Julia learned from their neighbors that their house had been the lifelong home of an old woman named Mrs. Alex Pickman. She had loved her Milwaukee home and had always told her husband and relatives that she fully intended to return there as a ghost. She had recently died and was buried in Omaha, Nebraska. Apparently, she hadn't forgotten her promise to haunt her former home. During the next few weeks, Mrs. Pickman continued to visit her old house, always between midnight and 1 a.m. The front door would slam open as if to announce the spook's arrival. Then footsteps would pace the house as Mrs. Pickman made her nightly rounds. The family also heard the ghost wheezing alarmingly, as though Mrs. Pickman was trying to catch her breath. The neighbors nodded knowingly. In life, Mrs. Pickman had had an asthmatic condition. One night, though, the ghost changed its habits. The Kubis girls, Helen and Armilla, were fast asleep at midnight. Suddenly, they were jolted awake by the thud of a body hitting their bed, followed by the commotion of someone invisible scrambling to get under the covers. The girls fled from the room, screaming bloody murder. The resident old lady ghost was behaving like a rowdy 8-year-old at a sleepover. The Kubis family had had quite enough. The very next morning, Max told Julia and the girls to pack their bags. They moved all their belongings out of the house that day. Well, almost all of them. In their hurry to get out of the haunted house, the family left behind the clock that sat on the mantel. Julia Kubis remembered it the next day and went back for it in the daylight. When she picked it up, she found that it had stopped at midnight. Haunts of Heartland. Spooky. There was a lot of strangeness tucked away in the wild corners of New England. One of these places is the ravine between Garvin and Heartland Hills in Vermont. These back roads are haunted by a commune of hippie ghosts. In 1971, so the story goes, five young men and two women rented a house nearby for Christmas. They were wealthy college students from out of state, and they told people they were there to go skiing at Woodstock. According to the locals, they were really there to smoke pot, a lot of pot. Whatever the reason, they were there on vacation, but tragedy struck when the house caught fire. No one knows how the blaze began, but it took mere moments for the flames to engulf the place. The seven students inside were too dazed to react, much less to escape. All of them were killed in the fire. Even today, locals driving the back roads around that land report seeing ghostly long-haired figures along the side of the road. One witness, a Mr. Sawyer, was a bit more detailed in telling of his experience. He says he saw a ghostly figure running down the road holding a flaming chair in his arms, eternally trying to escape his fiery fate. Oh, that's cheery. The things we do for love. The city of New Orleans is crawling with ghosts at every time of the year. These specters represent the same vivid cross-section of humanity that throngs the streets of this vibrant city in life. There is a house on the 700 block of Royal Street that features a rooftop ghost, a phantom, that is, shall we say, NSFW. The spirit is that of a young, pretty slave girl who fell hopelessly in love with a Creole man. The young man was handsome, but he apparently had a vicious streak. He promised to marry the young slave if she proved her devotion to him by spending the night on the roof of his house, stark naked. The girl was so besotted that one night, soon after, she actually did as he demanded. She stripped off all her clothes and lay down to spend the night. Unfortunately, she was too impatiently love-struck to wait for warm weather. It was a cold December night when she lay down. She never got up. Her would-be husband found her on his rooftop the next morning, frozen to death. Neighbors say that when December nights turn especially chilly, the young slave girl comes back, still trying to prove her undying love for her intended. She still wanders the rooftop of that house, her lithe, nude form backlit against the starry sky. The Christmas Rosebush. In West Virginia, many years ago, there lived a family by the name of Alts. They weren't a large family. In fact, there were only the three of them, Mr. and Mrs. Jim Alts and their daughter Anna. They were a happy, prosperous family with but one blot on their blessed lives. Anna Alts was quite sickly, and no doctor could explain her illness. One night, in early December, Anna suddenly got up from her bed. Her parents were astounded. Anna had been bedridden for most of her young life. Dreamily, as if in a trance, Anna threw back the covers, went to the door, and walked outside. Her parents followed, her mother wringing her hands with worry. Was Anna sleepwalking? Would it be wrong, even dangerous, to wake her? Anna wandered through the yard, her bare feet leaving small prints in the newly fallen snow. She came to a rose bush she had often gazed at through her bedroom window. Anna's strange journey out to the garden sapped what little strength she had. She sank to the frozen ground, her hand outstretched to the rosebush. Her mother and father rushed to her side, but it was too late. Anna was dead. Her parents were heartbroken at the loss of their only child, but they soon had a strange consolation. The rosebush began to bloom shortly after her death. It continued to bloom all year round, even into the winter months, even when the rosebush was covered in snow. Beautiful red roses dotted the bush. Several years later, Jim Alts and his wife moved to a new house. They dug up the rosebush and took it with them as a reminder of their lost Anna. They replanted the rosebush in the yard of the new house, but to their sorrow, it didn't bloom that spring, summer. Summer two came in with plentiful sunshine and rain, but still the rosebush didn't bloom. The Alts feared the rosebush had died. In early December of that year, on the anniversary of Anna's death, a light snow fell. The next morning, Mrs. Alts looked out the window and shrieked. Anna's rosebush was gone. Mr. and Mrs. Alts rushed outside to see what had happened. The rosebush had indeed disappeared, and small footprints in the dusting of the new snow led away from the spot where it stood. The grieving parents followed the footprints. They had to know who would dig up their daughter's beloved rosebush. They traced the footprints all the way to their end and stopped, gazing at the scene in wonder. The footprints led straight to the cemetery and stopped at Anna's gravesite. There, on their daughter's grave, stood the bush. It was covered with beautiful red roses in full bloom. Please help. Many years ago, Dr. Anderson was awakened by a frantic pounding on his front door. He dressed quickly and hurried down to answer it. The moon shone brightly on the white snow and on the young girl standing on the doctor's front porch. The doctor wondered briefly why she was out so late. It was past midnight, and the girl couldn't have been more than 12 or 13 years old. He didn't recognize her. She was dressed in a blue coat, and her shaking hands were thrust into a white muff. "Please help me," the girl begged through chattering teeth. "It's my mother. She's very sick, and I'm afraid she'll die." The girl explained that she and her mother had recently moved into the old Holster place, about 3 miles away. Her father was dead, and it was just the two of them now. "I think she's got pneumonia," the girl said. "Please, you've got to come see her." At the dreaded word pneumonia, the doctor gave a short, sharp nod. "Of course I'll come. I'll be just a moment." The girl turned and darted away, heading for the old Holster place. The doctor shrugged into his good sheepskin coat, grabbed his bag, and went to the barn to saddle his horse. As the horse trotted down the road, the doctor mused at the bravery of the young girl, who had ventured out after midnight in the bitter cold to seek his help. He was sorry she'd run off before he could invite her in to warm up just a bit. The ride didn't take long, but Dr. Anderson was still chilled to the bone when he came in sight of the Holster farmhouse. He swung down, tied his horse to the gatepost, and hurried up the walk. No one answered his knock. So he eased the door open. This chair is not as fun as the old chair. And came in. A woman lay huddled in a bed, wheezing and shivering. The doctor turned up the oil lamp and set to work. If he could break the fever, the woman might live. He trickled medicine down the woman's throat, then poked the fire to life so he could heat the water for hot compresses. He worked for a couple of hours, and soon the woman stirred back the lucidity. "How did you know to come?" she asked, as she accepted a cup of something hot and steaming from the doctor. "Your daughter came to my house to fetch me. She was very brave to come out on foot on such a bitter night." The woman's face paled even further. "My daughter died of pneumonia 3 years ago." "But who could it have been? If it wasn't your daughter, how would she know you were ill?" "I tell you, there was a young girl about 13 years old who showed up on my porch." "Who showed up on my porch. She was wearing a blue coat and a white muff." "My daughter had a blue coat and a white muff," the woman whispered. "They're hanging in the closet over there." Dr. Anderson strode to the closet and yanked open the door. There, hanging right in plain view, were a blue coat and white muff. With trembling hands, he reached out, and he tucked a finger inside the muff. The fur inside the white muff was damp, with perspiration. Okay. Footprints in the snow. It was a cold winter afternoon early in the last century. A mother huddled in her cabin on the west fork of the Little Pigeon River in Tennessee. She held two of her children in a tight embrace, but one was missing. Her two-year-old son had wandered away from the cabin earlier that day. Since then, the temperature had been falling steadily, along with the heavy snow. A neighbor came in, stamping the snow from his boots to grab a few moments' warmth by the fire. The mother looked up, hope dawning briefly in her eyes, then looked back down, defeated, at the shake of the neighbor's head. She was grateful, of course, that all the men folk were out looking for her precious little lost one. Word had been passed from cabin to homestead, from house to church, and soon the entire community was out looking. Her own husband was off in Europe, in the trenches, fighting the Germans. All she could do was pray that one of the neighbors would find her little boy, and soon. Dr. Thomas appeared at the door of the cabin. He dressed warmly for the trudge through the woods. He'd come thinking to help the young mother. One look at her stricken face, though, and he realized that he could best help not by doctoring her, but by finding her missing son. Pulling his heavy overcoat closed, he headed out into the snowstorm with the other searchers. Dr. Thomas struck off in a random direction, hoping he was looking at ground that hadn't already been covered. With the snow falling so thickly, the footprints of the searching men were soon being covered over. Dr. Thomas held his lantern high in the gathering dusk as he scanned the area. The shadows of the evening crowded close under the pines as the last light of day slipped away. The doctor stopped for a moment, listening to the silence of the woods. Somewhere, he knew, men were searching for the little boy with dogs. But he hadn't yet heard the deep bay of a hound on a scent. All around him, the snow fell in a silent hush. The branches of the pines swayed with the wind, even as laden with snow as they were. As night fell, the snowstorm grew worse. Dr. Thomas trudged along the dwindling path in the woods, stopping every so often to look closely at any fallen log that might shelter a shivering little boy. His toes were beginning to go numb, even with three pairs of socks. But he kept wandering the woods, his lantern held high in search of any sign of the boy. If he was cold, the toddler would be even worse off. Dr. Thomas stopped and turned in a slow circle. He couldn't give up hope, not while the boy was still out there lost in the storm. He held his lantern high, and there, on the ground, was one footprint. Dr. Thomas bent closer to study it. It wasn't the track of a deer or a dog. It was the footprint of a child who was barefoot. The doctor's heart leapt, and adrenaline spun in his cold fingers and toes, warming them briefly. Finally, here was some sign of the boy. The doctor looked around carefully for more footprints. There was another one, and a third. The bare footprints were just visible in the hard-packed old snow, and, as the doctor watched, more appeared, the feathery new snow blowing off of the old prints. Carefully, the doctor followed the prints. As soon as he passed the last one, the next one appeared, leading him farther into the woods. The doctor no longer cursed the biting wind, because oddly enough, the wind seemed to be blowing the fresh snow off of the prints, revealing the path that the barefoot toddler had taken through the woods. Dr. Thomas followed the footprints as they led to a patch of evergreens. The doctor lifted a low-hanging branch and gasped. There, curled up on a soft bed of fallen pine needles, was the young boy. But the doctor had come too late. The boy's skin was waxy white, and his little chest didn't rise and fall with peaceful sleeping breath. The boy had frozen to death in the storm. Dr. Thomas stifled a low moan and gathered the child up in his arms. He unbuttoned his coat and his woolen shirt and cradled the boy to his chest. The boy had died in the freezing cold. Although it was too late, the doctor could at least keep him warm for the sad walk home. He rebuttoned his coat and headed back to the cabin. As the doctor approached the cabin, the young mother came out to meet him. Seeing her there, silhouetted against the yellow glow of the lit cabin behind her, Dr. Thomas felt his spirit sink. How could he break this woman's heart? The mother caught sight of the doctor with his sad burden and ran to him. Dr. Thomas reached the open cabin door just as the woman came out, crying joyful tears at the return of her baby. The doctor unbuttoned his coat and opened his shirt. "I'm so sorry. At least I found him." And to his shock, the little boy blinked sleepy brown eyes at him. The child turned his head, hearing his mother's cry of joy. "Mama?" Stunned, Dr. Thomas handed the toddler to his mother, who cuddled him fiercely. She looked up, tears of gratitude standing in her eyes. "Thank you, doctor. Thank you so much. You saved my little boy. Please come inside and get warm." The doctor followed her into the cabin, his analytical mind fumbled for an explanation. The boy must have been chilled to the point where his vitals had slowed, putting him into a state of suspended animation. The walk back, cuddled against the doctor's warm chest and wrapped in the heavy overcoat, must have warmed the child slowly enough for him to recover with no harm done. The gentle warming had brought the child back to life as surely as the violet blooms in the spring. Vaguely, he became aware that the boy's mother was still talking. "I'm so grateful for you for finding him." She kissed the toddler, who sighed sleepily in her arms. Dr. Thomas roused himself from his thoughts. "Yes, I followed his footprints in the snow. I'm amazed he was able to wander so far with bare feet." "Bare feet?" the mother said, puzzled. "But he's wearing shoes." Frowning, Dr. Thomas lifted one of the boy's feet. Sure enough, the boy was wearing sturdy brogans. "I had to tie his shoes on tightly, with double knots, so he won't kick them off," the mother explained. "Here, have some coffee. It'll warm you right up." "Good job," a neighbor said, putting a tin cup into the doctor's hand. Dr. Thomas accepted the congratulations and heartfelt thanks of his neighbors. The little boy was safe. That was all that mattered. But the doctor's scientific mind wouldn't rest until he'd figured out the answer to the mystery. Several nights later, he woke from a sound sleep, sitting bolt upright in bed, reeling from a thunderclap of realization. The wind hadn't blown the fresh snow off of the child's old prints. The bare footprints had been appearing in the snow, step by step, as he'd been following them. He hadn't been tracking a living child. He'd been following an invisible child, a ghost or an angel. The chicken ghost. One night, in December 1943, a British airman stationed in London was out for a stroll. He was crossing Pond Square in Highgate when he heard a strange sound for the mid-20th century, the sound of carriage wheels on cobblestone. Then he heard an even more incongruous sound for a chilly December night in the middle of London, the loud screech of a chicken. The airman looked around in confusion. He couldn't see a carriage, but he did see a chicken running in disoriented circles and squawking with fright, and probably also with cold, because this chicken had already been plucked. The airman took a few steps towards the bird, hoping to help the poor shivering creature. But as he got closer, the chicken vanished. This chicken ghost has been seen in Highgate for over 300 years. It has a perfectly good reason to haunt Pond Square, and its story affects us even today. You see, that was the world's first frozen chicken, and it led to a revolution in food preservation. The story goes that in April 1626, Sir Francis Bacon was riding in a carriage through London with his friend Dr. Witherborne, a physician to James I. The sight of the snow-covered ground led to a discussion of the possible use of snow to preserve food. Looking out at the rolling wheels and the path left behind the carriage, Bacon pointed out to Witherborne that the wheels were packed with chunks of snow, and the grass revealed by the passing of the wheels looked fresh and green, even in late winter. Bacon's friend belittled his theory. Irritated enough to want to prove his point immediately, Bacon ordered the carriage to stop. He trotted to the nearest house and bought one of the household's chickens. He wrung the hen's neck, plucked it, cleaned it, and stuffed the carcass with snow. Then he packed more snow around the prepared bird. Bacon's experiment worked, and a new era in commercial food preservation was born. Unfortunately, Bacon's adventure in the snow led to his contracting pneumonia. He faded quickly and died on April 9, 1626. Soon after Sir Francis's death, visitors to Pond Square began to hear the squawking of a chicken about to be butchered, but no chicken was in sight. Then the audible became visible. People would see a plucked chicken running in confused circles before vanishing through a brick wall. The airman's experience, in 1947 was just one of the series of naked chicken sightings down through the years. The Eternal Beetle. The Dakota, the iconic hotel at the corner of Central Park West and 72nd Street, New York City, is a place that many New Yorkers call home. Several of them are ghosts. On December 8, 1980, John Lennon joined the ranks of the spirits who roam the Dakota's elegant hallways. Just outside the building's front entrance, Lennon was shot 4 times in the back and shoulder by Mark David Chapman. Lennon staggered a few steps, then collapsed near his frantic wife, Yoko Ono. The first reported sighting of Lennon's ghost was in 1983, when Amanda Moores, a musician Joey Harrow, saw Lennon standing in the archway at the Dakota's interest, mere yards from where he'd been gunned down. Perhaps being so close to the scene of his murder had put Lennon in a pensive, even foul mood. Moores almost walked up to the Beetle to say hello, but she said the look on his face let her know he wasn't in the mood to chat with strangers. Lennon was in a much better frame of mind when he showed up in his own apartment. Yoko Ono lived at the Dakota for 20 years after her husband's death. One day she came into the living room to see Lennon's ghost sitting at his white piano. He turned to her and said, "Don't be afraid, I'm still with you." Then he vanished. Before his death, Lennon claimed to have had his own paranormal experiences in the Dakota. He told of seeing a phantom he called the Crying Lady, who would pace the Dakota's hallways. Lennon was not alone. Many other witnesses have reported seeing the Crying Lady as well. She may be the spirit of Elise Vesely, who was manager of the building through the 30s and 40s and 50s. Vesely herself in life believed passionately in the paranormal. She even claimed to have telekinetic powers. Unfortunately, her son was hit and killed by a truck outside the Dakota. In response to the tragedy, Elise became very protective of the children in the hotel. This sense of responsibility may be why she still haunts the halls of the building. All right. Next story is Home for the Holidays. It's become somewhat of a joking urban legend to claim that Elvis Presley is still alive and well and flipping burgers in a diner somewhere in East Podunk. As part of American culture, Elvis sightings are right up there with UFO encounters. But even with all the National Enquirer articles shouting otherwise, the undeniable fact remains that Elvis Presley did indeed die on August 16, 1977, at Graceland in Memphis, Tennessee. So what sort of phantom Elvis are people seeing? The best guess is that it's just that simple people who claim an Elvis sighting are actually running into his ghost. The spirit of Elvis seems reluctant to leave this plane of existence. He appeared to an acquaintance, an elderly farmer named Claude Buchanan, just after he passed away. Elvis passed away. Claude said that before the news of Presley's death was announced, the figure of Elvis showed up and told him, "I've come to say goodbye for a while, Claude." But one year, Elvis decided to go home for Christmas. On December 20th, 1980, a truck driver named Jack Matthews was taking a load to Memphis, about 100 miles outside the city. He picked up a hitchhiker. The night was dark, and the hitchhiker was just a dim form in the passenger seat, a hat pulled low over his face. But the hitcher didn't seem like a threat to Matthews. On the contrary, he was well-spoken and polite, just the kind of company you'd want on a long trip. In a light Tennessee drawl, he told Matthews that he was going to Memphis to see his mama and daddy for the holidays. The hours passed in pleasant conversation. They talked quite a bit about cars, and the hitchhiker mentioned that he owned several Cadillacs. Matthews took the boast. For surely, you know, that's what it was. With a good-natured grin and a grain of salt or three. The truck rolled into Memphis, and in the glow of the streetlights, the hitchhiker's face began to seem somehow familiar to him. The man asked to be dropped off on Elvis Presley Boulevard, and that's when the penny dropped for Matthews. His passenger looked startlingly like the late entertainer. Matthews found the boulevard and carefully pulled the 16-wheeler over to let his passenger out. He stuck out his hand to wish the guy a Merry Christmas, and he realized he'd never told the passenger his name. "I'm Jack Matthews, by the way." The hitchhiker looked Matthews in the eye. "I'm Elvis Presley, sir." The Kennedy Road Phantom. Chicago and her suburbs are justly famous for the phantom hitchhikers that roam the streets. Hovering somewhere between urban legend and outright ghost story, these apparitions rack up the paranormal equivalent of frequent flyer miles with their many appearances to unsuspecting motorists. And the notorious Resurrection Mary is by no means the only spirit that wanders the highways and byways of the Second City. Take the Kennedy Road Phantom, for example. This mysterious female ghost first showed up near the town of Byron, Illinois, in December 1980. Her appearance was so shocking that once word got out, traffic was sometimes bumper to bumper along Kennedy Road, with curiosity seekers angling for a glimpse of the young lady. This may well have been because the slender young woman wore next to nothing, even in the frigid Chicago winter. One witness, Dave Trenholm, came to Chicago Tribune reporters with his story. He said that he was driving along Kennedy Road at about 9 p.m. on the night of January 2, 1981, with Gary Herod of Oregon. Dave claimed that the young lady stepped out from behind some bushes at the side of the road. She was, Dave said, tall, slender, nice-looking, about 20. All she was wearing were some black panties and some kind of scarf around her neck. This, despite the fact that the thermometer hovered around 10 degrees that night. As the woman spotted the car, she turned and ran toward a nearby farmhouse and vanished. Sightings like this went on for weeks, from December 1980 well into January 1981. Reliable witnesses filled police blotters with reports of the girl's clothing, or lack of it. Different witnesses described different outfits. The girl was seen wearing light-colored shorts and a sweatshirt, or shorts, and a light jacket, or even a tiny halter top. One detail remained constant. She was always skimpily dressed. This argued against the whole thing being a hoax. It would take a seriously dedicated or outright insane prankster to walk along the side of a rural roadway in the dead of winter, half naked. So who was she? A mentally handicapped girl had been reported missing by her parents around Christmas, and for a while, she became a possible candidate. But that theory was dismissed, putting aside the possibility of a joke. People naturally turned to the paranormal for an explanation. Perhaps she was a car accident victim who had returned to haunt the stretch of Kennedy Road. Or maybe she was the ghost of a woman who had been buried in a nearby cemetery, which had been abandoned and recently destroyed. The story took a gruesome turn in late January 81. The Rockford Register Star published a report that an Ogle County sheriff's car had struck a mysterious woman around 8 p.m. and run her over. The woman had suddenly appeared in the middle of the road, and the driver of the squad car had no time to react. The car slammed into the woman, and she was pulled underneath the vehicle. According to the officers filing the report, they heard her bones crunch and felt the impact of the tires rolling over her body. The squad car screeched to a stop, and the officers wrenched their doors open and flung themselves out of the car, horrified at what they'd accidentally done. They sprinted back up the road, aghast at the carnage that surely awaited them. But they never found the woman's body. Puzzled, the officers made their report and braced for the derision that was sure to follow. A police lieutenant called the story crazy and untrue, but the officers were simply doing their duty, which that night included filing a report of something unexplainable. By the end of January, the reports of the half-dressed phantom of Kennedy Road had begun to taper off. Soon, the pretty young ghost seemed to fade out of existence, despite the people still quite eager to see her. That was decades ago, but many ghost hunters still keep a sharp eye out for her as they drive down that lonely stretch of road, especially the guys. It came upon a midnight clear. Ghost stories of Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. It's finally Christmas Eve. The tree stands proud, its color lights twinkling softly in the dusk of the winter evening. The presents are wrapped, tomorrow's dinner is planned, and all is ready for the holiday celebration. What walks on this silent night? Santa stuffs the stockings. The following three stories come from the website paranormal.about.com, where people gather to share their odd experiences. The first story was shared by a reader with the screen name Misty G. When I was 9 years old, I'm 30 now, I could not get to sleep on Christmas Eve because I was excited about presents and wondered if my parents had anything to do with the gifts I'd received from Santa the year before. That night, it was hot because the heater was on. I lived in Texas. So I got thirsty. Also, I was wanting to spy. I got out of bed and cracked open my door to make sure no one was out in the living room, so that way I could get something to drink. When I opened the door, I saw someone bent over. Then he stood up. It was Santa Claus, dressed in the red and white getup. Something strange was that I could see the lights of the Christmas tree shining right through him. He was taking the stockings down off the mantle and placing them on the coffee table. When he started to turn around to put the next stocking on the table, I closed the door and jumped into bed. The next morning, I woke up and told my sister what I'd seen. I told her where he had put the stockings. When we went to the living room, the stockings were where I said he had left them. We both turned and looked at each other and froze for a moment. From then on, I have told everyone that I believe in Santa. Santa and an Elf. This story, also from ParanormalAbout.com, comes from contributor Skitty Scat. This incident took place near Seattle, Washington on Christmas Eve, 1957 or 58. Mom was at the kitchen window when she yelled for my sister and me, ages around 5 and 7, to come look. There was Santa and an elf carrying a big brown bag, walking down the middle of the street. My dad went running out the door to see if Santa would come and say Merry Christmas to us kids. But Santa, the elf, and the big brown bag had vanished. Okay. Next story, the ghost in the living room. And one more story from Arthur H. My mother, to whom I was very close, passed away in 1964 when I was 17 years old. I left home that year and moved to Ontario from Nova Scotia. In 1969, I met a girl, whom I will call Karen, and we got married in the March of 1970. In December of 71, we were expecting our first child. We were living in a small bungalow. There was a fireplace in the living room. My wife and I loved the fireplace, and we had it lit every night. It was Christmas Eve, 1971, and we had just finished putting the gifts under the tree, and a nice fire gave off a beautiful glow. On the tree, one string of lights, which was supposed to flash, had stopped several days before. It was 5 minutes to midnight when the fire in the fireplace suddenly went out and the string of lights started to flash, and the other lights stopped flashing. My wife and I were sitting on the floor, and it had become very chilly in the room. I looked over to my lazy boy chair, and a figure was sitting there, my mother, with a big, beautiful smile on her face. My wife, who had never met my mother, said she could see the same thing. This ghost never spoke, but just kept looking at me and my wife and smiling. At 12 midnight, the fire in the fireplace started up again, and the lights on the tree stopped flashing, and the others started flashing again. I looked over to the chair, and the ghost was gone. No matter what I did to those Christmas lights, they never flashed again. Okay, next story. That's not Santa. Murder, Suicide, Orphans, Five Children by Bruce Trachtenberg, Oregonian staff writer. A Portland mother of five, unalived of gunshot wounds early Sunday in an apparent murder-suicide in a North Portland home where she had sought refuge. Her former husband turned the gun on himself after first unaliving her, according to the Multnomah County Medical Examiner's Office. Unalived are Marles H., 36, Billy H., 42. Mrs. H. and the children had been living at the home of Mary E. Bellinger, where the shooting occurred. She came here in the hopes of finding some protection, Mrs. Bellinger said. We had known each other for about four and one half years. We used to live next door to each other. The medical examiner's office said Mrs. H. was unalived about 2:50 a.m. Sunday after she let her former husband in the house. Billy H., also unalived of a gunshot wound. Mrs. Bellinger said she hopes the children can spend Christmas with her family. I hope the court is good enough to let the kids stay here for Christmas. We want to try make this the best Christmas that we can make for them. We don't want to upset them any more than possible. The police youth division said later Sunday the children would be allowed to spend Christmas at the Bellinger's home. From the Portland Oregonian, December 24th, 73. Domestic violence pays no attention to the date on the calendar. If death is going to come from within the family, it doesn't matter what day it is. Marles and Billy couldn't work out their differences peacefully, and they both ended up dead. The violence tore apart the front room of the home. Marles was unalive just inside the front door on a couch near a glass fronted cabinet. The gunshots shattered the glass into 1,000 twinkling shards. Blood from the unaliving suicide drenched the room in gore. The couple's five children and family who took them in were unharmed, but the echo of that terrible violence still thrums through that North Portland, Oregon home. Marles and Billy still haunt the house where their lives ended in a blast of lead spray, of blood. 12 years after the tragic event in 1985, a family moved into the house that has sat abandoned for so long. Michael and Carolyn Brown had been looking, not seriously, for a large older home, and the three-story Victorian, just a block away from where they were living, came up for sale. It was listed at $58,000, but no one bought it. The price dropped several times, and the Browns became interested, even though the house had sat empty for a year and a half. The couple made an offer of $42,000, and the house was theirs. The Browns couldn't believe their luck. They moved into the house in November 1985, along with their daughters, Jeannie and Cassie. The Browns lived in the house for a year and a half before Carolyn began to have spooky feelings about their new home. It wasn't anything specific, nothing she could put her finger on, just a feeling of something being not quite right. 6 months later, she and Michael were talking about the house, comparing notes, as it were, and Carolyn discovered that Michael also found the house disconcerting in a way he couldn't explain to her or himself. Both Michael and Carolyn agreed that perhaps the floors in the home were a little too creaky, that perhaps the window in their daughter's Jeannie's bedroom shouldn't be opening by itself. A couple of years after the Browns moved in, a former owner of the house stopped by to see his old home. As he was leaving, he asked the couple if they knew that their home had been the scene of a murder-suicide. Shocked at the news, Carolyn and Michael did some investigating with the neighbors. Sure enough, the neighbors confirmed the story. A lady had left her husband and had come to the home of her friends seeking safety for herself and her children. Her husband had come after her, then unalived himself. Cassie, the couple's younger daughter, was the first in the family to see the ghosts of Marles and Billy. She told Carolyn that a nice lady would come to tuck her in at night, but that a man would also come into her room. Cassie, not yet 3 years old, found the man scary because he never smiled. He only watched. But the lady was kind and pulled the blankets up and tucked Cassie in, soothing the toddler to sleep. On Christmas Eve, 1989, daughter Jeannie snuck downstairs for an early peek at the presents under the tree. A man was standing near the tree, gazing at it, his back to the little girl. Jeannie caught her breath. Could it be her dad standing there, or even Santa Claus? The man turned to face her and vanished. Jeannie, scared out of her wits by the man who was obviously neither her father nor Santa, scampered back to bed. Much later, she told her parents what she'd seen. The man she described sounded a lot like the man Cassie had seen watching her in her bedroom. The Browns were forced to admit they were sharing the home with ghosts. One of the spirits made his presence known exactly a year later. On Christmas Eve, 1990, the Browns hosted the annual family Christmas at their beautiful, spacious home. Carolyn's sister-in-law had brought a tray of mixed nuts for the party. The relatives had all gone home, and Michael and the two girls had already gone to bed. Carolyn was in the kitchen straightening up the last of the party mess. "I was putting some stuff away and noticed that the tray with the nuts was halfway off the table," Carolyn said. "I pushed it back onto the table, and then I started putting things away again. And then the tray just flipped backward. It was like someone had taken his hand underneath and flipped it up. The tray hit the wall, and nuts scattered everywhere." Carolyn snapped off the lights and bolted for the safety of her bedroom. The spilled nuts could wait until morning. Next story, Poe finds his inspiration. Many connoisseurs of horror fiction consider Edgar Allan Poe to be the father of the genre. And one of his finest short stories is The Cask. I'm going to have to say this. The Cask is of Amontillado. This deeply creepy tale is a staple of high school literature classes, not mine, and for good reason. It's the story of a man who gets bricked, oh yes, this dude, who gets bricked up alive in a dungeon, a fate he thoroughly deserves. I just heard a different version of this. What most of these high school English students don't know is that Poe based his story on true events. Poe was born in Boston on January 19, 1809. In 1827, the 18-year-old Poe enlisted in the Army. His first posting was pretty close to home at Fort Independence on Castle Island in Boston Harbor. On Sunday, when he had some free time, Poe wandered outside the fort's walls, down to the water's edge. A monument there had caught his attention, and naturally, he wanted a closer look. On one side of the obelisk, Poe read the inscription. The officers of the U.S. Regiment of Lieutenant Archery erected this monument as a testimony of their respect and friendship for an amiable man and gallant officer. On the other side of the monument, Poe found a few lines from a poem by William Collins. Here, honor comes a pilgrim gray to deck the turf that wraps his clay. Curiouser and curiouser, Poe must have thought. He continued his circle of the obelisk. On the northern side, which faced Boston, he found yet another piece of the puzzle. Beneath this stone are deposited the remains of Lieutenant Robert F. Massey of the U.S. Regiment of Light Artillery. Near this spot, on the 25th December, 1871, fell Lieutenant Robert F. Massey, aged 21 years. Even in his late teens, Poe had the makings of a horror writer, and here was the seed of what promised to be an amazing story. All he needed were the juicy details. He did a little poking around on the slide, and before long, he had some very illuminating conversations with his fellow soldiers. 10 years earlier, in the summer of 1817, a young lieutenant named Robert Massey had been posted to the fort. He was a likable guy and made friends quickly, but there was one officer who just didn't take to him. Call it a personality conflict if you want, but truth was, Captain Green didn't much like anyone at the fort. He was a bully, plain and simple. The other men just tried to avoid him, but it wasn't always easy to do on the small island. On Christmas Eve, Massey, Green, and a few other officers settled in for an evening of cards. Massey and the other officers enjoyed the friendly games, but Green seemed determined to ruin Christmas for everyone. Around midnight, Massey won the hand of cards they'd been playing. With a grin, he reached for his winnings. "Well, Merry Christmas to me." Green leapt from his chair with a snarl and smacked Massey across the face with an open palm. "You cheated." Then he said the words that froze every man's blood. "I demand satisfaction." Lieutenant Massey knew he was in serious trouble. A duel of honor could not be ignored, even on Christmas Day. Even worse, he knew Captain Green was an expert swordsman. He spent the remaining hours of the night tossing in a cold sweat of the dreaded anticipation. The next morning, at the break of dawn, Massey and Green met outside the walls of the fort, along with their seconds. In the singing cold air, their seconds, following tradition, pleaded with the two men to set aside their impending duel. But Green refused, and Massey had no choice but to go through with it. The duel began with a clash of steel. Massey did his best to defend himself, but Green pressed his attack. On that cold, clear Christmas morning, he wanted to kill. Massey gasped as Green's cold blade pierced his chest. The duel was over within moments. The young lieutenant's men lifted him gently from the sand and carried him to the infirmary. Robert Massey died later that afternoon. Massey had been respected and well-liked by his men. He'd made friends in the months he'd been at the fort. His men moved through their days in a haze of depression and grief. There was no reason Massey had to die. A young man cut down in the prime of his strength just to satisfy some bully's lust for killing. Then, some of Massey's friends learned some information they found very interesting indeed. They already resented Captain Green for the capricious death of their friend Massey. They were intrigued to learn that Green had goaded his officers and other forts into duels on equally flimsy pretexts. In short, Green was responsible for the deaths of six other men. He was, Massey's friends realized, a sociopathic killer who chose to murder his victims in plain sight. Robert Massey's friends had a monument erected to mark the spot where he'd been run through. At nearly the same time, a strange thing happened. Captain Green disappeared. The top brass at the fort could give no explanation, so after some time, he was considered a deserter. Green was never seen or heard from again. But the story, Poe discovered, didn't end there. One night, still mourning the senseless death of their friend, a handful of Massey's fellow officers paid Captain Green a visit. They brought several bottles with them. Never one to turn down a free drink, Green lifted a few glasses, and still, the other officers kept topping off his mug. Soon, Green was knee-walking drunk. Two burly officers propped him up, one under each arm, and they went for a walk. The whole group manhandled Green out of his room and down to one of the old dungeons of the fort. Earlier that day, the officers had gone searching for the most remote of the abandoned cells. The dungeon had fallen out of regular use, but the cells were still equipped with the iron shackles of days gone by. The men hustled Green down to the dark, filthy cell and dragged him through the narrow door. They dumped him onto the dusty floor and clamped the rusty iron manacles to his wrists and ankles. Green came to a groggy half-consciousness and slurred a question, what the hell was going on? Then, realization cut through the fog of alcohol. The officers ignored him as he began to yell and struggle against his chains. Silently, they mixed mortar and began to take bricks from the pile stacked next to the door. It didn't take long for the men working together to brick up the narrow cell door. It took longer, probably much longer, for Green to die screaming in the pitch blackness. The officers involved all requested transfers to other forts. But before they all left, whispers began among the lower ranks. The story was shared in low, muttered tones. 10 years later, there were still soldiers at Fort Independence who remembered the true story of the fate of Captain Green. They shared that hushed tale with budding horror writer Edgar Allan Poe. The higher-ups got wind of Poe's research, and he was called into the office of the fort's commander. Poe was told that he was strictly forbidden to tell anyone the story of Massey's duel and its grisly consequences. Poe agreed to the gag order. Of course, no writer could sit on a juicy story like that forever. Many years later, Poe composed a story set in Europe titled The Cask of Amontillado. He was forbidden to tell the story, but no one had said he couldn't write a story that had its roots in the sand of Castle Island, roots that reached down into the dungeons far below the ground. But there is yet more to this story. In 1905, a work crew on the island discovered the oldest section of the fort. On comparing the prison cells to the fort's original plans, the crew realized that they didn't match. A bricked-up section of the wall captured their attention. Maybe the missing cells were behind the wall. The foreman called for more light and a couple of pickaxes, and the men set to work solving the mystery. After a couple hours' hard work, there was a hole in the wall, large enough for a small man to fit through. The man came back out of the cell much more quickly than he'd gone in. "There's a skeleton in there," he gasped. The men pulled down the rest of the wall, revealing a skeleton dressed in the tattered remains of an 1812-year army uniform. Rusted shackles still encircled the bones of the wrists and ankles. The skeleton's jaw hung open in a soundless scream. The remains were never identified. They were simply given a military funeral and buried in the cemetery on Castle Island. The gravestone reads, "Unknown." Funny that the unknown soldier rested on the same island where Lieutenant Massey's monument stands tall and proud, or at least it did for a while. A bridge was built in 1891 that connected Castle Island to Boston, and thousands of weekend visitors came to see Massey's monument. In 1892, a new cemetery was opened on Governor's Island, and the monument and Massey's remains were moved there. In 1908, the body and monument were moved again to Rest Haven Cemetery on Deer Island. Massey was allowed to rest in Rest Haven until 1939, when he and his monument were uprooted once again and moved halfway across the state to Ayer, Massachusetts. Robert Massey was finally buried at Fort Devens. May he rest in peace until the next time someone moves him. All right. Next story is Christmas in the Woods. Do you guys want to continue tonight? See if we can finish this off, or do we stop and come back next Sunday? What do you think? What do you think we should do? Do we want to continue? Thank you for the happy birthday. Should we continue? What do you guys think? Maybe go another half hour? All right, let's go another half hour. I know we've got to be really close on this, so let's go another half hour. Let me get back in here. Okay. Christmas Carols in the Woods. The old man had retired from the Baltimore and Ohio Rail Line. The engineer had been known for his love of Christmas season. Every December, he'd buy sacks of candy to toss to the children who lived in the houses along the tracks, like a rolling Santa Claus. And he would bellow Christmas carols as he worked, filling the railroad cars with cheerful song. His retirement package had allowed him to buy a phonograph and start a collection of records. Most of them, predictably, were of Christmas music, my kind of people. The old man got a few visitors during the Christmas season, even with his house tucked away in the woods. Any time a friend or family member stopped by, the man would cheerfully invite them in to sip coffee and enjoy his small collection of records. When the old man passed away, his relatives came to clean out his tiny house. They took his records and his cherished phonograph, and the house was left empty. In 1968, the old B&O tracks that ran past the house were taken up and not replaced. The old man's house fell to the wrecking ball as well. No sense in leaving it if no one lived there and the tracks were gone. All that was left was the old track bed. Hunters found it a useful trail into the deep woods. Years after the old man died, not long after his house was demolished, a hunter was in that part of the woods. It was 2 days before Christmas. The hunter was driving carefully down the track bed, mindful of the noises of the forest around him, when he heard a sound that had no place in that part of the woods. It was the sound of a Christmas carol coming from a well-worn and well-loved record. Pops, scratches, hisses, and all as the needle coaxed the tune from the aging vinyl. The hunter stopped his car and turned off the engine to make sure his imagination wasn't playing tricks on him. All around him, the music rose, spreading through the trees. The hunter shook his head at the weirdness of it and turned the key in the ignition. His car wouldn't start. Frantically, he stomped on the gas and twisted the key again. The motor just wouldn't turn over. Then the hunter saw movement ahead of him. An old man was crossing the track bed. The man walked slowly up to the front porch of a house that had shimmered into view next to the phantom train tracks. The hunter watched the man open the front door of the tiny house as the music got fainter and fainter. The house, the old man, the last strains of music all faded away together. This time, the engine caught, and the hunter wrenched the steering wheel around and slewed through the woods to get out. On his return to town, he stammered out his tale. He was astounded to find that some of his audience, the older folks, actually believed him. They remembered the old engineer who lived in the house in the woods and loved the Christmas season so much, and who invited visitors in to listen to his favorite records. The next night, Christmas Eve, 13 boys set out for the woods in 3 cars. They wanted their own experience in the dark forest. They drove on to the track bed, out to where the old engineer's house had once stood. They parked, shut off their cars, and waited. The boys' experience was just a little different than what the hunter had reported. They didn't see the phantom house, and they didn't see the old man crossing the tracks to get to the house, but they heard the music, rising among the trees, sounding just like an old Victrola cranked up to wheezy full volume. And their cars wouldn't start until the music faded away. The boys went back out for a few nights after Christmas, but nothing happened. Legend has it that the music can only be heard in the days leading up to Christmas. After Christmas Day, the old phonograph falls quiet, and silence returns to the woods along the tracks until the next Christmas season comes around. St. Mary's Church. The town of Crompton, Rhode Island, now part of West Warwick, began in 1807 when a cotton mill was built on the Pawtucks River. The town thrived with the success of the mill. In the 1840s, the potato famine struck Ireland, and Irish immigrants killed in textile trades immigrated to America. Many of them were drawn to the employment offered by the mill at Crompton. Unfortunately, the area had originally been settled by English Protestants. The Irish Catholics who moved into the area a generation later found a firmly entrenched intolerance. The closest Catholic church was in Providence, which was a good 10 miles from Crompton. Few of the mill workers could afford wagons, and a 10-mile walk every Sunday soon became onerous. The Irish were desperate to build a Catholic church of their own town, but the Protestants refused to sell them the land on which to build. The Irish Catholics finally found friends in Paul and Mary Doran. The Dorans bought a one-acre lot, then turned around and deeded it to the Roman Catholic Bishop of Hartford. In 1844, the ground was broken for the construction of a church. Mary Doran died young. In fact, she died soon after work was begun on the church. There were whispered rumors that her death was the result of a retaliatory curse flung by the enraged Protestants. But whether Mary Doran's death had a supernatural aspect or not, it seems pretty clear that she is still very much a part of the church she helped to found. The small church holds an air of eerie mystery. Many members of the congregation, especially children, feel uneasy within its walls. Even today, some parishioners refuse to go into the church alone at night. Friar Edmund H. Fitzgerald, who was pastor of St. Mary's from 1984 to 92, readily admits that he believes the church is haunted by the spirit of Mary Doran. He has been alone in the church countless times, and many times he would hear footsteps on the hard cedar floor. The footsteps would come up right behind him, but when he turned around, there was no one to be seen. Sometimes the church's organ, majestic tones would ring out, even when the instrument was closed, locked, and covered with its cloth. As unnerving as these episodes may have been, though, Father Fitzgerald says he never felt uncomfortable in the church or frightened of the invisible presence. Friar Fitzgerald experienced a very special aspect of the haunting one Christmas Eve in 1989. He had offered the Mass of the Christ Child that afternoon. By 5 p.m., the last of his parishioners had left, and Friar Fitzgerald was locking the church to leave himself. Suddenly, the tower bell began to ring on its own, pealing out over the church grounds. Friar Fitzgerald immediately went back into the church to investigate. The bell rope was moving up and down, all by itself, but there was nobody in the church. He wrote later, "That bell can only ring from someone pulling on the rope. Even recent hurricanes did not cause that bell to ring this way." But Friar Fitzgerald wasn't alarmed by the spectral bell ringer. "What better time for it to ring," he said, "than to celebrate the birth of the Christ Child." Next one is The Lady in the Pantry. On Christmas Eve in 1985, a canon living in Conshaugh, Ireland, was relaxing at home in the rectory when his cook came into the room. Nervously, she pointed out that there was a strange noise going on in the kitchen. It sounded to her like the noise of a heavy wagon rolling past a rickety house. The canon had no idea what to make of this, but his cook was obviously alarmed. So he called another servant, and the three of them, canon, cook, and manservant, went down to the kitchen, which was in the basement. By the time they got back to the kitchen, the house was vibrating as if the grip of an earthquake. But none of the furniture and dishes were being jostled. They were all perfectly still. The two servants were on either side of the canon, each holding onto an arm, terrified at the eerie disturbance. Suddenly, the vibration stopped. But beyond the closed pantry door, the three of them could hear a tremendous racket. It sounded like someone was throwing every china plate, bowl, and glass onto the flagstone floor. Crash after crash came from behind the locked door, while the servants clung to the canon for dear life. The door was locked, but the key was in the lock, and the canon decided to open the door and investigate. He reached for the door, but before he put his hand on the key, the locked door of the pantry swung open. A tall woman glided out of the pantry. She was wearing a loose white dress with a short black cape around her shoulders. The canon was paralyzed with fright, and his two servants were holding onto his arms so tightly in their own fear that days later the canon had bruises from the panicky grip of their fingers. The canon wrenched away from the servants to follow the ghost, who had moved across the kitchen to the stairs. When the ghost reached the bottom of the stairs, it vanished, and the canon's two small boys, in their bedroom, three stories above, started screaming. The three thundered up the stairs to the boys' bedroom. The boys were shaking, terrified at the ghostly intrusion. The older boy, who was 10, told his father that he had been lying awake in his bed, waiting for Santa Claus. But instead of the jolly old elf, a strange lady glided into the room and then went back out. And she hadn't left any toys, either. The canon and his servants searched the rectory from top to bottom, but they found no trace of the lady in white. And when the cook opened the pantry door, which was still locked, she found no broken china, and nothing was disturbed. Mrs. Eustace returns. The dead must leave us for a while, it's true. And, sometimes, our grief at losing them can feel overwhelming. But if we are lucky, our loved ones will find a way to let us know they still care for us, even beyond death. Dr. Eustace's wife died early on Christmas Day, 1932. The widower was devastated by his loss, but he believed that his wife's spirit lived on, and that they would someday be reunited. But as the bleak days and weeks without her wore on, Dr. Eustace drew his grief around him and resigned himself to her loss. About 7 weeks after his wife's death, Dr. Eustace was taking an evening stroll in his garden. Suddenly, he stopped in his tracks. There, in the fading light of the setting sun, stood his beloved wife. Dr. Eustace later wrote about the experience. She stood looking straight at me as though she'd been expecting me. Her face and figure were distinct and clear-cut as in life. She gazed intently at me. Translated into words, her expression would have been well rendered by, "How stupid of you. Why so foolish?" I believe that I smiled and that my face reflected my joy. But the surprises were not yet over for Dr. Eustace. His wife's friend, Mrs. Welch, came by to offer her condolences. During their conversation, Mrs. Welch claimed to have seen Mrs. Eustace on Christmas Eve, the night before her friend had died. Mrs. Welch had attended the midnight service at the convent of Poor Clares. She had gotten to the church at 5 minutes before midnight, and she said Mrs. Eustace had been at the church too. Mrs. Eustace had greeted her friend and taken her by the arm, helping her to her seat with a smile. When Mrs. Welch had learned the next day of her friend's passing, she realized that, of course, it hadn't really been Mrs. Eustace at the church, but that her friend's spirit had been the one to help her to her seat. As Mrs. Welch spoke of her experience, Dr. Eustace recalled something else about that Christmas Eve. As he stood by his wife's bedside, he had noted that she lost consciousness at 11:55 p.m., the exact time her spirit was guiding Mrs. Welch to her seat at the church. Hey. The phantoms of the Mamie are mine. The winter of 1894 was a very bad time to work at the Mamie are mine on Raven Hill, at Cripple Creek, Colorado. 3 men had already died at the mine over that year. In the darkness, any misstep had the potential to kill. One miner had been killed in an unexplained blast. Another miner had had the bad luck to be standing under the bucket used to transport workers to the surface when the new cable broke. The falling bucket smashed the miner into an unrecognizable mass. Outside the mine, things were no less dire. A man named Garrison, who ran the mine's boarding house, came down with mountain fever. 9 days later, he was dead. On November 15, 1894, E.D. Blake was appointed manager of the boarding house. On Thanksgiving night, Blake was working at the top of the mine, along with a foreman named Fatty Root and 2 other men. They were all working near the hoist bucket. Suddenly, the signal bell rang 3 times, then once. This was the signal for man aboard hoist away. The hoist men started the bucket on its upward climb, but before it got all the way to the top, the bell rang once, the signal for stop. Then it rang twice, or lower away. Then the bell started ringing randomly, throwing out a bizarre contradictory mix of signals. This was all kinds of wrong. The bucket and windlass were the miner's lifeline to the surface. It was far too serious of a piece of equipment to waste the operator's time with silly games and mixed signals. Blake and Root decided to put a stop to the shenanigans. Ignoring the bell signals, they hauled the bucket up and climbed in. They bumped and clanged their way to the bottom, the shaft. Grabbing lanterns, they both went all the way through the workings. There was no one down at the bottom. When the 2 men came back up, the hoist operator said that no one had come up before them, either. A few nights later, a miner was working at the 375-foot level. He came up to the top, ashen-faced. A man, he said, had just been killed. The miner said he had been placing charges for blasting. As he worked, someone had walked right past him, straight into the middle of the blast zone. He had yelled at the man to get out, but whoever it was had ignored him. Then the charges had detonated. As soon as the smoke from the blast had cleared, the foreman sent workers down to investigate. When they got down to the 375-foot level, They were met by a horrifying sight. A man stood in the lantern light, blood streaming from several ugly gashes on his head. One of his arms had been blown off. He stood with it slung smartly over his shoulder, like a rifle. The men were appalled at the sight of the mutilated miner, but they were astounded that he was still alive. They yelled at the man, but he ignored them. Perhaps, and quite rightly, he was in shock. One of the rescue party stepped forward to take the miner's good arm, and his hand went right through the injured miner. The shift boss grabbed a drill and poked at the man, and the drill swished through the specter as well. The ghost brushed past the men, headed for the bucket, and rode up to the top. The rescue party waited until their racing hearts had calmed down. Then, they too rode the bucket up to the surface. The hoist operator at the surface swore he hadn't pulled the bucket up but once for them. The hauntings continued. On Christmas Eve, Blake, Root, and two other workers were once again at the top level of the mine near the bucket. The bell sounded three times, then once. "Who's down there, Root?" the foreman asked. "There isn't anyone down there," the hoist operator said, but he just couldn't ignore the signal. Better safe than sorry, after all. He started up the hoist. What happened next, according to E.D. Blake, was recorded in a WPA Writers Program report, dated 1936 to 1942. All three of us started back, and the blood curdled in our veins. Started back. I hope to be spared ever seeing such a sight again. Garson got out of the bucket first. Garson, with his yellow pinched face and staring eyes, just as he looked the night I saw him die of mountain fever. Then came the one-armed man, with the blood spattered over his features and the shattered arm. Between them, they lifted out the body of a poor fellow, lashed on a plank, and laid it on the platform. Then the one-armed man reached down into the bucket and brought out his arm. As he rose from the stooping posture, he looked toward us, the most ghastly object I ever beheld. His face old cuts, his clothing torn to shreds. He laid the arm on top of the body that was lashed to the plank, and the two raised the whole horrible thing to their shoulders and walked out into the night. For a minute, no one spoke, and then we all rushed to the door, and as true as I live, we saw the two dead men, ghosts or whatever they were, walk over to the edge of the dump and disappear in the darkness. But the Mamie R. wasn't finished, claiming its victims. That night, the mine flooded. The next day, Christmas Day, the miners had to work on emptying it, one hoisted bucket at a time. Around midnight, Fatty Root relieved the bucket dumper and was working the hoist. The men of that shift had brought up a dozen buckets of water, and the 13th was nearing the top, when the winding spool slipped out of its frame and the cable whipped out in great deadly loops. One of the cable loops caught Root around the neck and looped and unalived him right then and there, quick as thought and as cleanly as a guillotine. Many of the mines in the American West were worked by Welsh, Irish, and Cornish immigrants, men descended from miners themselves, men who brought with them generations worth of expertise in working underground. Those immigrants also brought with them a rich tradition of folklore, tailored to their specific calling of working deep under the earth. The Tommyknockers were a fairy race who lived underground. Sometimes these pixies were helpful locating miners' lost tools, leading them safely out of the tangle of mine shafts, or warning them of impending cave-ins. But sometimes the Tommyknockers could be maliciously manipulative. They would steal tools and lunches. They would tap a miner on a shoulder and laugh at his confusion, and sometimes their tricks were deadly. The Tommyknockers would toy with senses gone dull in the unrelenting darkness. They would pretend to be a lost child crying for help, luring miners deep into an unshored shaft, leading them into the very real danger of a cave-in. The miners claimed they could tell when the Tommyknockers were around. They spoke of a feeling of being watched, but if a miner whipped around to catch the culprit, all he would see was a skittering shadow, a shadow that would disappear right into a rocky wall. The miners also spoke of hearing voices, unintelligible whisperings, that would melt away into the dark. When they did catch glimpses of their tormentors, it was a horrifying sight. The evil imps were said to be 2 to 3 feet high, thin and wiry, with eyes that glowed a sullen red in the black shadows of the mineshafts. The Mamie mine closed shortly after that Christmas Day tragedy of 1894. There is no record of that particular mine, as the mining records of the State Bureau of Mines for Colorado only began in 1895. But perhaps in an abandoned mine, somewhere in the rocky wilderness of Cripple Creek, tommyknockers still chatter in the dark, and dead miners still travel up and down in the derelict hoist, still toiling in the mines decades after the accidents that stole their lives. The wreck of the General Arnold. The year was 1778. The young country of America had declared its independence from Britain just 2 years before. King George III wasn't about to let his colonies go without a fight. The American militia needed all the help it could get. In December, the brigantine General Arnold set sail from Boston. She carried 20 guns with a crew of 106 to man them. The brig was a privateer, meaning that she was privately owned and outfitted as a warship by her owner. Ships like this were issued letters of marque by the province of Massachusetts, allowing them to legally chase down British ships and plunder them. With these letters of marque, the ships and their crew rode at the fine line between legitimate raiding in a time of war and outright piracy. By Christmas Day, the ship had gotten as far as Gurnet Point outside of Plymouth Bay. The captain, James McGee, anchored there and signaled for a pilot to take the ship safely into the harbor. But a storm was brewing up fast, and no sane pilot would risk his life in such nasty weather. Without a local mariner to guide the brigantine into the harbor, Captain McGee would have to take his chances navigating the unfamiliar shoals on his own. McGee decided to ride out the storm in Cape Cod Bay for the night and hope a pilot made his way out to the brig the next morning. That turned out to be a cataclysmic bad decision. The storm grew worse during the night. The General Arnold, already dragging anchor, went aground on white flats in Plymouth Bay. The ship was still a mile off of Plymouth's shore and being forced further into the sand. Then the tide went out, leaving the ship stranded and listing in very shallow water. And the storm that had been menacing the ship turned into a deadly nor'easter. For 3 days, wind and snow pummeled the General Arnold, with temperatures plummeting. The snow froze to the sails and the lines of the ship. Captain McGee ordered the men to chop the mast down to lighten the ship in hopes of floating her off the sandbar. His plan didn't work. Also, the men, once they had axes in hand, used them to break into the ship's cask of rum. The men went below decks to wait out the fury of the storm, but under the force of the pounding waves, the seams split and frigid, water poured into the ship. The men were forced to back up onto the deck in the wind and snow. Then the tide came back in. Waves washed over the deck, adding to the misery of the already freezing crew. There was one small boat on board. Three of the men decided to take the yawl and rowed ashore for help. They risked being battered to pieces by the pounding waves, but they decided it was worth a try. It's unclear whether they came up with this plan on their own, or if they had Captain McGee's permission to make a run for it. The men piled into the yawl and were able to row to the frozen part of the bay, where they walked across the ice to a schooner that had gotten trapped. The three men who made their escape never did come back. Around sunset on Saturday, December 26th, the tide went out again. The brig was no longer battered by the pounding waves. But during the night, the wind shifted to the northeast, bringing bitterly cold temperatures. Soon enough, the tide came back in with accompanying waves. Unable to seek shelter below decks, the men were exposed to the cold on deck. Sailors clinging to the ropes of the rigging to avoid being washed overboard froze to death where they were. By the next morning, 30 of the men were dead. The survivors stacked the frozen bodies to provide a windbreak as the storm's fury lashed the decks. As the snow continued to fall thick and fast and waves battered the decks, the stacked corpses froze into a solid wall of flesh and wet clothing. By Sunday, December 27th, the townspeople of Plymouth realized the brig was stranded on White Flats. They tried time and time again to row out to the foundered ship, but the storm was still too strong, and Plymouth Bay was a churning mass of ice floes. The crew was forced to wait another agonizing night. The morning of December 28th brought hope. The people of Plymouth, desperate to provide some help to the suffering crew of the ship, had worked through the night, piling ice floes together to form an enormous bridge out to the sandbar. After 3 days of bitter cold and howling winds, the storm broke. The people of Plymouth cautiously ventured out onto the White Flat. The storm had brought such vicious cold that the salt water in the harbor was frozen. The townspeople, bundled against the cold, walked over the bridge to the ice to see if anyone was still alive aboard the ship. 70 men were dead. The townspeople dragged sleds over the ice bridge to rescue the survivors. 33 survivors were led, shivering, to warmth and safety on the shore. Of those men, 9 died later. Then, the gruesome task of recovering the frozen bodies began. "Here was presented a scene, unutterably awful and distressing," wrote a witness. "It is scarcely possible for the human mind to conceive of a more appalling spectacle. The ship was sucked 10 feet in the sand. The waves had been for about 36 hours sweeping the main deck. 70 dead bodies, frozen in all kinds of postures, were strewed over the deck. The townspeople of Plymouth decided to lay the bodies in the courthouse, as it was one of the largest buildings in the town, with plenty of floor space. There was, however, one horrifying flaw in this plan. The bodies of the sailors that had been stacked to provide a grisly windbreak on the General Arnold's deck were now frozen into a solid chunk, far too big to fit through the courthouse door. No one wanted to hack the frozen meat apart, so the mass of bodies was put into town brook to thaw. The town's water supply was a freshwater spring that bubbled up in a constant stream, so it was slow to freeze. The fresh water helped to thaw the bodies enough that they could be parted apart. The bodies were arranged in rows on the courthouse floor. While thawing the bodies, the rescuers noticed something odd about the corpse of Barnabas Downs. The 12-year-old cabin boy, a fresh tear seemed to leak from his open eye. Suddenly, the boy blinked. He was still alive, although paralyzed with hypothermia. Downs was saved, although he lost both of his feet to frostbite. He lived into his 50s and wrote a memoir of his experiences. In the book, he wrote that as bad as losing his feet was, the pain of getting thawed out was many times worse. In the end, several of the bodies were claimed by relatives, but many of the sailors had simply signed on to the ship in Boston, and Captain McGee hadn't yet had time to add them to the ship's log. They remained unknown, and no one came to claim their bodies. After a couple of weeks, the townspeople realized that even in the cold weather, the corpses had to be buried, and soon. Around 60 unclaimed bodies were buried in a 10-by-20-foot pit on Burial Hill. The pit, probably a rubbish dump that had been dug before the ground froze, was pressed into service as a mass grave. Captain James McGee lived on and had a successful career as a merchant captain. He died in 1801, and at his request, his body was buried in the mass grave that held the bodies of so many of his comrades. This tragedy left a stain on the courthouse in Plymouth, both figuratively and literally. It's said that the floorboards were so saturated with blood and body fluids that they had to be taken up and turned over. And the psychic residue has led to active hauntings that continue even today. Janice Williams, leader of the Dead of Night Lantern Tours in Plymouth, tells the story of the wreck of the General Arnold with ghoulish relish. Of course, that's the way she tells all the stories on her tour. She describes the sound you might hear if you stand in the ladies' restroom, which is located in the basement of the courthouse. It's a shuffling sound, the sound of freshly thawed bodies being dragged across the courthouse floor and arranged in row after row. She will show you the picture on her phone that shows 3 young cabin boys peering out of one of the courthouse windows, and another picture of one of the dead sailors. These pictures are also posted on the Dead of Night Tours website. And Janice will warn you with glee that if you are a woman visiting the courthouse museum, you might feel a friendly arm slide around your waist in an affectionate hug. But it's not anyone you know. When you turn around to smile at your companion, there's no one there. Just the spirit of a lonely sailor looking for warmth and maybe a smile from a pretty girl. Up in flames. Every family has their own way of celebrating the holidays. Some gather with friends for a big meal on Christmas Day. Some celebrations are a little smaller, more laid back for the Roonies. A couple in their 70s living in Seneca, Illinois, Christmas Eve, 1885, was a time to sit back and relax with a drink or three. Patrick and Matilda Rooney, both 72 years old, owned a small but prosperous farm just north of Seneca, about 75 miles southwest of Chicago. Joining them for the festivities was John Larson, their hired hand. Neither Patrick nor Matilda were shy about lifting a glass. Patrick kept his little brown jug of whiskey topped off once a week. Handily, his son-in-law, Michael Murphy, who lived nearby, owned a saloon, and was happy to keep his father-in-law in booze. That night, Larson came in from doing his chores. Patrick and Matilda were already enjoying a cup of Christmas cheer. Larson had two glasses of whiskey, then went off to his bedroom, which was on the second floor of the house, just above the kitchen. He had chores to do in the morning, but the Rooneys decided to stay up for a while longer. Larson woke up in the middle of the night. His eyes itched, his throat was scratchy and raw, and he had a hard time catching his breath. He thought miserably that he must be coming down with a cold. Before he could get up to get a drink of water to soothe his parched throat, he drifted back to sleep. The next morning, Larson got up and went downstairs to start in on his chores. He went to Mr. Rooney's room to wake him. He found Patrick Rooney unresponsive in his bedroom. Larson, concerned that Rooney had passed out after a night of drinking, tried to wake Rooney to help him to his bed. But after shaking Rooney a few times, Larson realized the old man was dead. Larson hurried to Matilda Rooney's room, but his boss's wife was nowhere to be found. Larson began to work out what had happened. He figured that maybe the Rooneys had had a fight. Matilda had killed Patrick, then run away. Larson walked to the Murphy home and told the family of his theory. Michael Murphy came back with Larson to the Rooney home to investigate further. The two men searched the whole house, trying to find any clue as to where Matilda might have gone. As they passed Larson's bedroom, Larson glanced in through the open door and noticed something that had escaped his attention in the grogginess of first waking up. His pillows were black. Larson picked one up and looked closely. The pillowcases were covered with greasy black soot. Larson, thoughtfully. This was probably why he had woken up coughing and short of breath in the middle of the night. The two men searched for Mrs. Rooney and in the kitchen. The stove, the table, the chairs were all covered in the same black slick of soot. And in the center of the room, there was a hole in the floor, charred around the edges, several feet wide. Sickened, Larson and Murphy made their way to the edge of the hole and looked down. On the cellar floor beneath the kitchen, one floor below, lay all that was left of Matilda Rooney. A part of her spine, her skull, one hip bone, and a pile of white ashes. Her left foot was still in the kitchen, standing at the edge of the hole in the floor. Her leg had burned through at the ankle, and when her body had fallen through the floor, the charred bone had snapped her foot. Her foot, with the shoe still on it, had toppled upright on the kitchen floor. It was the only part of Mrs. Rooney that wasn't incinerated. Besides being covered in soot, like the glass chimney of a smoky oil lamp, the only damage to the kitchen was that the edge of the tablecloth had been scorched. Well, that and charred, gaping hole in the middle of the floor. The LaSalle County coroner, Dr. Floyd Clendon, had only one body to autopsy. He determined that Patrick Rooney had died of smoke inhalation. John Larson, since he slept with his bedroom door closed, had been lucky to escape the same fate. As for Matilda Rooney, the coroner just scraped the ash from the cellar floor along with the bone fragments. He later reported that it would have taken a fire burning over 2,500 degrees Fahrenheit to incinerate Matilda's 160-pound body. He was at a loss, however, to explain how such an intense fire could burn only her body and not the rest of the kitchen or the house. John Larson was briefly considered a suspect in the deaths of Patrick and Matilda. But a couple months later, he was exonerated on the strength of his character. Matilda Rooney's death is one of the best-known cases of spontaneous human combustion, but is by far no means the only one. There have been over 200 reports of people mysteriously bursting into flames. One of the earliest recorded in Paris in 1673 involved a woman who caught fire and exploded on the street. Witnesses said she had been drinking, which seems to fit the pattern of alcohol involvement in cases of SHC. Victims are usually heavy set, and they are often female. Strangest of all, nearly all of the reported cases have occurred in the northern hemisphere, many of them during the winter months. Sadly, the Rooney's reputation suffered after their grisly ends. The Ottawa Republican Times ran their story on December 31, 1885, with a judgmental headline, "Tragic End of an Old Couple Whose Weakness Was the Cause of Their Sad Demise." Even some of their descendants believe that the deaths were the result of divine retribution for the Rooney's excessive drinking on Christmas Eve. All right, guys, we're going to stop there, and it looks like we'll be back next week with this. And like I said, we're getting really close to the end, so... Yeah, I'm going to go ahead this week, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to pick a book. I'm going to pick 5 books you guys can choose. And so what we'll do is we'll have that book ready to go so that if we do come to the end of this, like midway through the show, we can start the new book. Okay? So I'm going to go ahead and find some book. But I think that's going to be it for tonight because we've been at this an hour and a half. Okay? All right. Thank you guys for coming. I want to, and tomorrow, of course, I'm not going to do readings tonight. But I will be back tomorrow at 7 p.m. Pacific to do some card readings for you guys, 3 card over at TikTok. For those of you that want to join me from YouTube, just come on over to TikTok, look for California Haunts Radio, or join us at Clapper, because we're going to be over at Clapper as well. All right, so I'm going to say goodbye to everybody, and good to see you all, and I will see you tomorrow on TikTok. And tonight I will be, stay awake tonight, I will be booking shows so we can get this thing up and rolling over here and keep the radio show going and more in a decent pace. Okay, so thank you very much over here, and I appreciate it, and I will see you guys when I see you.